Good afternoon. We'll let some of our participants in. While we do that, the warmest of welcomes to the Lautis Path Centre for International Law here at the Faculty of Law in the University of Cambridge. My name is Marcus Gehring. I'm going to chair this book launch event this afternoon on the art and craft of international environmental law, the second edition. And with us today, launching their new book, are Professor Dan Budansky. Dan is the Regents Professor of Law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He is a leading authority in international environmental law and global climate change law in particular, and teaches public international law, international environmental law, and the law of armed conflict. He's widely published and is a recognized authority in the field. His book, The Art and Craft of International Environmental Law, was first published in 2010, and we'll hear about that in a second. Professor Hyre van Asselt holds the Hutton Professorship in Climate Law at the University of Cambridge. He's a Fellow of Law in my own college, Hughes Hall, and is also a professor of climate law at the University of Eastern Finland and a researcher at the Stockholm Environment Institute. Until recently, he was the editor-in-chief of the Review of European Comparative and International Environmental Law, RECIEL, and has been a visiting researcher in many national and international institutions. A very warm welcome to both of them. And what we're going to do, and welcome to our online audience, what we're going to do is first hear an introduction to the new book and then open it up to questions first here in the room and then to our audience online. And for the audience online, please post your questions into the Q&A button in Zoom. Dan.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much, Marcus. It's a pleasure to be here. I was a student at Cambridge many years ago, and it's always a pleasure to come back. And I've had the opportunity to be coming back every summer, thanks to Hugh Hunt at Trinity College, who's invited me back. So thank you, Hugh. What we're going to be talking about today is the second edition of The Art and Craft of International Environmental Law. I wrote the first edition about 15 years ago. It reflects my background as a State Department lawyer initially. That's how I got my start and as a climate change negotiator. The second edition, I was extremely pleased that Hyre van Asselt agreed to come on as the co-author of that. He brought a different perspective, maybe a less embarrassed US-centric perspective. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to first give a little bit of background on the first edition, and then Hyre is going to talk about how the second edition book has evolved. So this is How to Think Like an International Environmental Lawyer version 1.0. That's the first edition. And the first edition, like its successor, is multidisciplinary and pragmatic. And I wanted to just bring out five key points about the first edition. So first of all, it views international environmental law as a distinct tool. Secondly, it takes a very process-oriented approach. Third, it focuses on the effectiveness of international environmental law rather than on compliance. Third, it's very treaty-centric. Fourth, it's very treaty-centric. And fifth, it views international environmental law as what I call a 30% solution. It's not the full solution to international environmental problems, but it can contribute. 30%, of course, was not mathematically calculated, but to indicate that it's significant, but not the key. So the first point is that international environmental law is a distinct field. And this can be viewed, I think, in a weaker sense or a stronger sense. The weaker sense is just that international environmental law is a particular subfield of international environmental law, which has its own content. But I mean to say that international environmental law is a distinct field in a much stronger sense, that it has distinctive rules about how law is created, how it's enforced, what kinds of institutions exist. So it differs in a more fundamental way from other areas of international law. I gave a talk when I was writing this book about whether one has to be an international lawyer to be an international environmental lawyer. And my answer somewhat provocatively was, no, you don't have to be an international lawyer to be an international environmental lawyer, because international environmental law is quite distinct. It has distinctive sources, it has distinctive institutions, it has a distinctive approach to compliance. So it really differs in some fundamental ways from other international law. So it's distinctive in terms of the way norms get created, how standards get set. The treaty regimes are not static. They're highly dynamic in nature. They change over time in a way that most other treaty regimes and other areas of international environmental are much more static. They reflect an agreement at a particular point in time, but they're not intended. They're not built so as to be evolutionary in character. I'll come back to that a little bit later. Secondly, there's a lot of emphasis on soft law rather than hard law instruments. This is true in other areas of international law, but I think it's particularly true in international environmental law. And a lot of the soft law is set through private standard setting rather than through intergovernmental processes. International environmental law also is distinctive in terms of its institutions. Its institutions are much more political than legal. The central institution in all multilateral environmental regime is the meeting or conference of the parties. It's kind of a hybrid. In many areas of international environmental law, there isn't such a central role given to a political body like the Conference of the Parties. And in terms of implementation, the compliance committees are much more political, I think, in nature than they are legal. And that brings me to the compliance more generally. Traditionally, in international law, the focus of compliance was on state responsibility. The question was whether there had been a breach of an international obligation. And then if there was a breach, what the consequences would be. It was adversarial in nature, where one country invokes responsibility of another country, dispute settlement and potential restitution and compensation. In international environmental law, in contrast to this backward-looking approach to compliance, it takes a much more forward-looking approach. The non-compliance committees set up under multilateral environmental regimes are forward-looking. They're not adversarial. The purpose is not to adjudicate whether or not a country has breached its international obligations. The purpose really is to try to figure out what's gone wrong and what can be done to bring a country back into compliance going forward. So it's working with the country in many cases to try to figure out what can be done to enable it to comply. So often the reaction to a breach is not some kind of restitution compensation, it's actually providing the country participants so that it's able to comply with its obligations going forward. So international environmental law, there's a blurring of lines, I think, between the political and the legal, between the public and the private, between the international and the domestic, which makes it quite distinct. Second general point is that there's a focus in international environmental law on process rather than doctrine, or focus on process rather than doctrine. Most of the other books written on international environmental law when I wrote this book really were doctrinal in orientation. They tried to go through different issue areas of international environmental law and say, what does the law provide? What does the treaties provide, and so forth? The art and craft of international environmental law focuses much more on the process by which international law gets created, how it's implemented, how it's enforced, and so forth. So the doctrinal approach, I used to say, assumes that there's courts, because really the purpose of trying to figure out what the legal answer is doctrinally is to try to convince a court of the answer. But they're playing to an empty house, because courts, this has changed now in the second edition, but in the first edition, I think courts played a very modest role in international environmental law. So the focus on doctrine was making arguments to an audience that didn't really exist so much. The process approach that the art and craft of international environmental law reflects is much more, I think, practical. The question is, how do we get from here to there? You know, how do we move from where we are currently on an international environmental issues to some kind of more effective regime? So the focus is on how international environmental law emerges, develops, influences behavior, who are the principal actors, what motivates them, why and how do they develop legal rules, why and how do they influence behavior. And it views international law, I think, much less as a sort of fixed doctrinal area, and much more as an argumentative practice. You know, what kinds of arguments can be made back and forth. They're institutional settlements in the form of treaties, but they're really part of an ongoing dialogue or conversation between states. So nothing is ever fully settled. Everything is still open going forward. The third point, I think, that's distinctive about the approach of international, the art and craft of international environmental law is how we approach the issue. How do we evaluate success? Traditionally, in most areas of international law, the measure of success is whether there's been compliance, whether or not countries have met whatever rule is in an international agreement. There needs to be a congruence between norms and behavior. But in international environmental law, compliance is really not the key metric of success, because you can have complete compliance with a regime that does nothing, that has such low standards that countries would be complying even if the regime didn't exist. So really, the more important tests are the behavioral effects of the treaty. Does it actually cause changes from what would have happened in the absence of the treaty? And so, also, how effective ultimately is in solving a problem? What is the problem-solving effectiveness? So compliance is really, I think, secondary in importance. The more important questions is how much behavioral effect does the treaty have and how much effect does it have in solving the problem? And the book presents the issue of effectiveness in terms of a trilemma, where effectiveness is a function of how strong the commitments are, how strong the norms are, but also who participates in the norms and how much implementation and compliance there is with the norm. So you need, if you have very strong norms and countries don't participate or they don't comply, it's not going to be effective in solving a problem. Conversely, if you have a treaty that's has very strong participation but very weak norms, it's also not going to be effective. So you're trying to maximize what the overall effect of the treaty is on behavior, which is a function of the strength of the norms, but also how much participation there is and how much implementation and compliance there is. The fourth general point is that the art and craft of international environmental law is first and very treaty-centric. When I teach international environmental law, really three quarters of the course is about treaties and about a quarter of the course is on everything else. Why treaties? Why are treaties so central in international environmental law? First of all, they allow states to address issues in a purposive, rational manner. They promote reciprocity by establishing reciprocal norms in the treaty between the participating states. They have a canonical form. You can look to the treaty text to see what the norm is rather than be arguing about state practice and whether or not state practice is sufficient to create a customary norm. And they allow states to tailor institutions to a particular issue area, because the treaties not only establish norms, they also establish institutions, and you can tailor the institutions you create to the particular subject matter that you're trying to address. So if you think about treaty design, there are a number of different functional tasks in designing a treaty, like the climate change agreements, or like the treaty that's now being negotiated to address the problem of plastics pollution. How do you promote stringency? How do you encourage participation? How do you promote compliance? How do you encourage the treaty to evolve or progress over time as we understand a problem better or as the problem itself changes? And there are a number of different variables in treaty design that can be used to try to address these functional tasks. What's the scope of the treaty? What kinds of norms and commitments does it contain? What institutions does it create? What are its amendment procedures? What kind of carrots and sticks does it have to try to promote participation and compliance? So if you think about treaty design, it's a question of how do you use these variables to solve the functional tasks that a treaty has to achieve. So just take one example of this, commitments. Typically, when people talk about commitments, they're focusing on the stringency of the commitment, what exactly does it provide, how much change does it require for business as usual. But there are a number of other factors in treaty design that are also important in designing a treaty. What type of commitment do you use? Is it an obligation to adult or an obligation to conduct? What is the strength of the commitment? How binding is it? How flexible is the commitment? How much does it prescribe something internationally rather than allow countries to nationally determine what they want to do? How differentiated is it? How do you provide for uniform standards as opposed to differentiated standards? And let me just drill down on one of these different variables. And there's all these different variables, but one of them, the strength or bindingness of the commitments. This was one of the big issues in the negotiation of the Paris Agreement was how binding would the commitments in the Paris Agreement be? And bindingness, in my view, is not a single variable. It has various sub-elements. So there's the legal form of the agreement. Is it a treaty or is it a decision or resolution? How mandatory is the language of a particular provision? Does it say shall or should or may or will? How precise is the provision? Does it say something very specific, like you need to reduce your emissions by 8% by certain year? Or does it say something much more general? And then how much international supervision and enforcement is there? How much is there an ability to get some kind of compulsory third-party dispute resolution? So you can adjust all four of these variables. You know, you can manipulate these to get treaties. Provisions that are more or less strong. And if you look at something like the Paris Agreement or the decisions implementing the Paris Agreement, they represent an extremely modulated approach to the question of bindingness, where they sometimes have something that's quite precise that isn't so mandatory, or something that's more mandatory but less precise, and so forth. Another functional task of treaties is to promote participation. And this can be done in a variety of ways by adding or subtracting issues. The Biological Diversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Treaty, basically they were able to promote participation by joining together four different issues in a single treaty and combining them. You can try to lower the cost of joining by providing assistance, by trade measures. You can raise the cost of staying out, for example, by imposing trade measures against non-participating states. So there's a lot of different ways that treaties can be designed to try to get more countries to participate in them. And then a fourth, another functional task is to build the treaty regime over time. How do you build a treaty? It's not a single point in time, it's an evolving process. And how do you do that? And the book discusses two different strategies: start wide and shallow, start with broad participation, and then move to greater stringency. Or the alternative is to start deep with a very stringent treaty that not too many countries participated in, and then try to widen it out. And the book tries to explore those two different approaches. And my fifth and final point, that international environmental law is a 30% solution. I think a lot of people get disillusioned with international environmental law because it can't solve the problem of climate change. In my view, that's true. It can't by itself solve it, but it can make a contribution. It's part of the solution, not the entire solution. It's a tool to allow states and other actors to further their interests and be able to address problems. So the book distinguishes two different conceptions of international law: law as a stick and law as a facilitator. Law as a stick is where law imposes specific constraints, compulsory binding dispute settlement, sanctions for violation. This is the familiar law from domestic legal systems. But the Art and Craft of International Environmental Law tries to provide an account of international environmental law more as a facilitator than as a stick, where it encourages and enables cooperation. It helps build consensus over time. It addresses barriers to cooperation, such as mistrust, lack of capacity. So it's trying to explore this other approach, or another way of another kind of role that international law can play. And this is my final slide. It views, if you're trying to think about international environmental law as a facilitator, the book presents what I call the diagnostic method, where you try to first diagnose what the barrier to cooperation is and then see how international law can try to address those barriers. So if the barrier is lack of political will, the treaty can try to build more cognitive consensus. It can try to promote scientific research. If the problem is that there are domestic political differences, the treaty can try to empower domestic groups that are in favor of stronger action. It can try to solve collective action problems by changing the calculus of costs and benefits for states, make commitments more credible, build trust. I can try to address lack of capacity, which is often a significant barrier to addressing a problem like climate change, by providing financial and technical assistance, by providing information. So the approach of the book is not to try to say, okay, here are the norms and let's try to enforce them against states. The approach is more, what are the barriers to cooperation? Why are countries not able to make more progress in addressing a problem? And then how can international environmental law, while not solving the problem, make some incremental contribution to addressing those barriers? So that's international environmental law version 1.0. And now Haro is going to explain what's changed in the last 15 years, because I wrote the Art and Craft in 2009, 2010. A lot's happened since then. And I think in some fundamental ways, international environmental law has changed. And so Haro is going to be describing that. So thank you.
And while Haro takes the podium, I should say that Dr. De Pledge, Joanna De Pledge, Joel has unfortunately been taken ill. She was going to be the first commentator on the book launch, on the presentation. So we'll have to, so she can't join us today, but very much would have liked to be here today.
Haro. Thanks, Marcus, and welcome everyone. And thanks, Dan, for not only introducing the first edition and giving an overview of the approach of the first edition, but also for welcoming me into the second edition. Like many others, I used the first edition also in my teaching and also my own thinking. So I was very honored and I feel still very privileged to have contributed to the second edition of this book. But as Dan said, indeed, things have changed, right? Like, and lots of practical things have changed. We've had, since 2010, we've had the SDGs, we've had the Paris Agreement, ongoing plastics negotiations, BBNJ, planetary boundaries, so new concepts, new frameworks, all kinds of things that have changed practically. But if we want to summarize these in maybe a few trends, I think there's a number of things that we can highlight particularly. The first, as you can see here as well, is the growing role of non-state actors. And of course, non-state actors were already prevalent also in international environmental law before when the first edition came out, but we can really see a step change since that time. So increasingly, we see a growing role of private governance, and I'll touch upon that in a second. The second is that we see also a growing role of courts and an increasing importance of doctrine, kind of, and Dan already provided the hints at that, but kind of going against some of the core foundations that were in the first edition, and also indicating there's a different role of international law, perhaps. And it's something we'll touch upon, hopefully also in the discussion later on. And lastly, again, not necessarily an entirely new development, but certainly something that became more prominent in the last 15 years or so, is that we see a growing importance of the interactions between international environmental law and a whole range of other issue areas at the same time. So, and we capture that in the book under the heading of architecture. So I'll touch upon each of these 3 points in the coming slides. So first, on the growing role of non-state actors, you can see that in a number of ways. You can see that, first of all, in participation. And here, if you just look at the slide, so at the UN Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972, maybe a little bit more than 100 NGOs participating. Already in Rio, two decades later, we already saw quite a significant growth. But then if you go to Dubai last year, we see now more than or almost 4,000 observer organizations participating in climate change negotiations. So we see a very rapid growth, particularly in the last few years, in a range of different organizations. And also, it's not just environmental NGOs that we're looking at. We're talking about trade unions. We're talking about business organizations, religious organizations, investors, a great variety of different non-state actors that are increasingly involved in the making of international environmental law. But we also see in the implementation of international environmental law that these actors are playing a growing and changing role. And this comes from the UNFCCC website. And around the time of the Paris Agreement, the so-called NASCA portal was launched, which is now the Global Climate Action Portal, under which non-state actors can list their own commitments. And we increasingly see businesses, but also local authorities and other actors adopting their own net zero targets, adopting their own local climate action plans, and increasingly trying to indicate, well, we are also taking action. And of course, this was very prominent when the Trump administration came into power in 2016, with lots of US local authorities and other organizations saying, no, we are still making our own commitment to implement the Paris Agreement, even if our national government isn't doing so. So again, it's a bit of an indication of how the role of non-state actors is changing. And beyond the actual commitments adopted, we also see all of these non-state actors increasingly becoming involved in standard setting. So actually not just trying to adopt their own commitments to implement international environmental law, but also trying to govern their own behavior by setting standards of behavior themselves. So again, we see, especially in the last 15 years, a significant step change in this area. Then the second development that I already briefly highlighted is the changing role of courts. And we see this particularly at the national level, but also increasingly at the international level. So let me talk about each of them in turn. So the national level, you already see some indications from my home country here, and you'll probably know about them as well. In the Netherlands, we had the Urgenda ruling, first by the district court in 2015, and later by the Supreme Court in 2019, basically telling the Dutch government to increase the ambition of its climate targets. Likewise, we had the ruling against Royal Dutch Shell in 2021. Again, in this case, the same district court in The Hague telling a company to also increase its climate targets in light of human rights as well as national law. Now, more broadly, when we look at climate litigation, and I think climate litigation is perhaps the most telling example, where we also see similar developments when we look at biodiversity, air pollution, and who knows also in the future, plastics. We see increasing amount of national litigation trying to force governments as well as companies to strengthen climate action in pursuit of international agreements. And we see here that from the latest LSE report that 70% of these cases were since the adoption of the Paris Agreement in 2015. We also see a greater number of jurisdictions involved. And clearly the majority of cases, as you can also see over there, is still in the United States, maybe followed by Australia. But we see increasingly also jurisdictions in the Global South and in other countries adopting these types of cases. So we see a growing spread as well. Also important, we see what is called a growth of so-called framework cases, where the ambition and implementation of climate targets for entire economies and societies is being challenged by NGOs and other actors. And lastly, especially in the last few years, we see a growth of litigation against corporations, not just again the framework litigation to get corporations to adopt higher targets, but also very specific litigation, for example, against greenwashing or climate washing, as well as not taking into account transition risks. So again, we see definite developments, and particularly again in the last 10, 15 years or so. But also at the international level, we see quite a bit of movement. And here we listed some of the cases for the International Court of Justice. And of course, already at the time of the first edition, there were some important cases. We see, again, some very important cases also coming afterwards. So before, at the time of the first edition, Gapsigova Nagimaras was probably the main case in international environmental law, as well as the advisory opinion on nuclear weapons, which also had some important things to say about the state of international environmental law. But since 2010, we see a number of contentious cases arising. So just in 2010, of course, the pulp mills case, but also since then, Japan whaling, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and most recently, the Silala case between Bolivia and Chile. And of course, in the terms of advisory opinion, we have now an ongoing advisory opinion on climate change obligations and legal consequences attached thereto before the International Court of Justice as we speak. So very clearly, the International Court of Justice is increasingly called upon to pronounce on certain rules of international environmental law. But like the International Court of Justice, we see also other international courts and tribunals increasingly becoming involved. And we see this in the human rights realm, where we have the Human Rights Committee pronouncing on a number of cases, for example, the Torres Strait Islanders case against Australia. We have the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which rules on an application by Greta Thunberg and others. We see regional human rights bodies. Just earlier this year, the Clima Signorina case before the European Court of Human Rights, pronouncing on climate change, but also in other regional bodies, so the Inter-American Court, for example. Also there, we see an advisory opinion on climate change, but also a few years ago, we had a very important advisory opinion on human rights and the environment. International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, also there, we just last month had an advisory opinion on climate change obligations. And then if we go on, we also can look at the WTO dispute settlement body. We can look at investment arbitration or arbitral tribunals. Again, all of these pronouncing one way or the other on international environmental law. And this goes also to the third point that we're trying to make clear, is that increasingly international environmental law is not just its own self-contained body, but increasingly we need to look at other bodies of international law as well, and we need to think about the interactions between them. And this includes, of course, human rights law, trade and investment law, intellectual property law, also refugee law, and also very recently criminal law, with the move to try and get ecocide recognized as a crime under the Rome Statutes. So what we try to do in the book, so we developed a new chapter that we call The Architecture of International Environmental Law, to try and capture this complexity and to try and see what causes it, what might be the consequences, and how can we deal with that complexity. Because increasingly we know that it's not as simple as just looking at one treaty and the follow-up decisions made by a treaty body. So maybe in the past that would have been the approach that we could take with the Whaling Convention, just look at the convention, just look at its schedules, just look at the decisions adopted by the International Whaling Commission. But increasingly these days that won't be sufficient. And the climate change regime is perhaps the most obvious example there, where we cannot just look at the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement and the COP decisions adopted pursuant to those treaties. No, we also need to look at what's happening in other international legal regimes. We need to look at what's happening at the national level, at the subnational level, try to see how all of that interacts with each other. We need to also look at what business actors are doing, what NGOs are doing, and how all of that comes together. So increasingly, to really understand how international environmental law is working in a given issue area, we need to appreciate and understand its complexity. Now, again, just to emphasize and bring home the point in the context of climate change, so this is a report from a few years ago, some of my former colleagues at the Free University in Amsterdam, and we see a growing number of institutions. And again, some of these will be intergovernmental institutions led by national governments, but increasingly we see also business-led and NGO-led institutions, as well as hybrid institutions. And it's this development is also very nicely captured in what Ken Abbott and Duncan Snyder are calling the governance triangle, where you can actually map all of the different institutions according to the actors who are involved in them. So they have some institutions which are still government-led and government-driven, others led by either civil society organizations or businesses, and others working with some combination of these three actors. So, again, going back to the point, so we tried to capture all of these developments under the broader heading of architecture. And just to be clear what we mean with that, we don't think that there's an architect that, or that there should be an architect that comes up with the design of how international environmental looks like or should look like, but we rather think of this as the result of a number of conscious and unconscious decisions by a whole bunch of architects, whether state or other actors, that ultimately determine the structure of relationships between these different institutions, between these different rules in a given issue area. And we argue that these architectures can be either more coherent or less coherent. And just to give you some examples of more coherent architecture, could be looking at, for example, the relationship between the climate regime and the ozone regime, where we see two institutions working quite well together, dividing who does what, and also supporting each other when it matters, for example, on the phase out of hydrofluorocarbons. But we also see architectures where there might be low coherence. And here the example that we give also in the book is the relationship between climate change and the investment regime, where we clearly see conflicting objectives, which might also lead to conflicting rulings of investment tribunals. I won't go through all of the benefits and costs also in the interest of time, but again, you can look it up in the chapter as well. But clearly, there might be some benefits to greater complexity and the fact that the multiple institutions involved in a given issue areas. If we see several institutions working quite well together, such as the climate regime and the ozone regime, we can see actual synergies being reaped. We can see in some cases very bespoke solutions being developed. We look, for example, at how the International Maritime Organization and the International Civil Aviation Organization are developing their own rules for the aviation and shipping industries, targeted and using the infrastructure that they already have for these specific sectors. We can also think of it from the perspective of experimentalist governance. So maybe the more we have, the more experiments we have, the more we can learn from each other, and the more the best solutions will survive. But of course, on the other hand, there might also be costs and risks involved in having a multitude of institutions governing the same issue. There might be conflicts between the goals, between the principles, or even between the rules of different institutions. And there might be inefficiencies and duplication of efforts, where maybe some countries need to report to multiple institutions with the same information. And there might even be inequities as well, especially if powerful actors actually are able to abuse this multiplicity and this complexity, because they can more easily navigate it than less powerful actors. What we then also do in this chapter on architecture, we also identify different ways in which states and other actors can try and deal with this complexity and try to come up with the best possible outcomes given a complex governance system. And we divide this into different groups or different types of approaches in which states can do this. One of them would be what we call hierarchical approaches. So where there would be either overarching goals. And a very clear example is, of course, here, the Paris Agreement temperature goal of keeping global warming below 2 degrees and ideally 1.5 degrees. But we can also see the sustainable development goals as one of the ways in which the international governance system tries to impose and tries to achieve overarching goals. Of course, this can also be challenging in the sense that there will very often be trade-offs, particularly if you look at individual SDGs. Another way of achieving a hierarchy would be to establish a norm hierarchy. And then, of course, under international law, there's no international environmental constitution, as Dan has written about in the past as well. But it might be possible to come up with other hierarchies, either through the use of so-called savings clauses or conflicts clauses that regulate the relationships between different treaties. It might also be by resorting to general rules of international law, for example, the rule of lex specialis or lex posterior. So there might be ways in which we can create, in some cases, a hierarchy between different norms of different international regimes. And another way of looking at hierarchy would be to try and see, is there any international organization that has a superior status compared to others? And there have been plenty of proposals in the literature for a World Environment Organization or as a counteracting organization to the World Trade Organization, for example. But of course, we don't have such an organization as it stands. Having said that, of course, we do have a UNEP that, since its creation in the 1970s, has been significantly upgraded then. But even then, I wouldn't argue that UNEP by now is the international environmental organization. Again, maybe I'll go through the other ones slightly more quickly in the interest of time. Other approaches for managing complexity would be to coordinate between different institutions. And again, there are multiple ways of doing this. Giving observer status to other secretariats, exchanging information through liaison groups, having joint activities. And one example we give here is in the area of trade and wildlife, where we have multiple international organizations working together. Clustering, very innovative approach that we see with the synergies process under the Basel, Rotterdam, and Stockholm conventions, and so forth. The division of labor is a form of institutional coordination, but it's particularly one where two different institutions agree, okay, you do this and we do that, and we try to make sure that we complement each other's activities. Orchestration, again, a concept that came out of the literature after Dan's book was originally published, where we have international organizations or national governments maybe enlisting intermediaries, which could be also in the form of non-state actors that would then try to achieve the ultimate goals. And lastly, there might be ways of unilateral adaptation where one regime might borrow ideas or emulate ideas from another regime, or where one regime might simply interpret terms with reference to norms and provisions from other regimes. Right, then my final slide, and also just maybe to kickstart the debate a little bit, and because this goes back to Dan's earlier point about does one need to be an international lawyer to be an international environmental lawyer? And Dan's provocative answer at the time, as he said, was no. But maybe things are changing a little bit, or maybe things seem to be changed, because now things are somewhat different if we compare it to 15 years ago. So 15 years ago, I would probably side with Dan, very clearly you can be a climate lawyer and focusing simply on the problem of climate change and look at the international climate regime and know and understand all of its abbreviations, all of its jargon, all of its specialized terms to really understand how the international climate regime is working. And there will be their own rituals, their own terminology that one just needs to get into. And if one does that, one understands the regime. But increasingly, and this is also going back to this development that we pointed to with increasing court decisions at the national and international level, we see increasing involvement of general international lawyers in international environmental issues. So increasingly, we see judicial opinion weighing in on what international environmental law is, and maybe also having a particular lens. And if I go back to one of the core criticisms of international law by Martti Koskiniemi, who has been arguing that international environmental lawyers, and particularly maybe international climate change lawyers, have been managerialist. And the argument was that, well, it's too technical, it's too technocratic, and we need to move away from that, and we need to move back to general international law to properly understand the regime. But I think we've come now to the point where we can really question that. Is that indeed a good thing? Is it good to move away from maybe this managerialist approach that has been adopted in the context of, for example, the international climate regime? And do we need to adopt toward a more general international law lens at specific environmental problems? And maybe we should, but maybe also there might be risks to that, because maybe we cannot trust courts to actually come up with the best possible solution for something that has been negotiated for three decades among more than 190 parties. And maybe if there are certain interpretations of rules, maybe there will be less flexibility in these negotiations moving forward as well. So going back to also what Dan was saying about the fact that there's merely punctuation, but there's not a final conclusion, bringing the courts back in might actually hamper that process of incrementalism that has characterized international environmental law so far. And I think the question I think that we can throw open to debate is that a positive development or not? And I know that Dan has his strong views about that, which I'm sure he'll be sharing with us in a minute. But I would also be happy to hear any other views on that from the audience, both here and online. So I'll leave it at that, and hopefully we'll have sufficient time for some questions here in the room and online.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.